When you look into a mirror, you expect a basic one-to-one reflection.
Right, it's a foundational binary.
Exactly. You raise your left hand, the mirror raises its left hand. You rely on it being this completely objective, unfiltered readout of reality.
Yeah, that grounded reality is basically how we navigate the world. We outsource our situational awareness to these tools.
We trust them completely. But imagine looking into that mirror and your reflection calmly tells you that the room you're standing in is currently engulfed in flames.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You look around and there's absolutely no fire, but the mirror insists it's showing you burning walls.
So suddenly the very instruments you use to gauge reality are just fractured.
Right. And you're trapped in this epistemological nightmare. And that is exactly where we're starting today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today is Wednesday, March 18th, 2026.
Glad to be here with you all.
So, our mission today is to unpack a richly detailed role-playing chronicle from the realm of Mirari, specifically the Palace of All Seasons. We're going to extract the core mechanics of crisis management, the anatomy of disinformation, and the execution of a high-stakes tactical infiltration.
It's a fascinating case study. We are analyzing a civilization caught in this immediate institutional paradigm shift.
Okay, let's unpack this because we are dropping right into the claustrophobic aftermath of a massive revelation.
The reality-shattering kind.
Totally. The villain, Lord Aeon, who is literally known as the Destroyer, has just been unmasked after posing as the rightful heir, Lord April, for months.
And the whole realm is just spiraling into chaos.
Complete chaos. And we find our main characters, Alice, who goes by Lady Jill,
Yeah.
and the Golden Hawk warrior, Hannah, in the palace infirmary.
Right, they're catching their breath on those massive cloud-like beanbag chairs.
Yeah, it's this fleeting moment of sanctuary after the intense violence at the South Gate.
And that quiet infirmary setting serves as this brilliant psychological pressure cooker. I mean, the physical battle is paused, but the cognitive battle is just starting.
And that battle walks right through the door.
Exactly. In the form of Simon.
Right, Simon the Page Boy, the kid from the mortal world who, bonded with Alice over doing skateboard tricks, he just bursts in.
And we immediately see the devastating effects of Eowyn's psychological warfare. Simon is just
He
frantic.
completely refuses to believe Lord April was an imposter.
He's constructed this whole counter-narrative instantly. He thinks Queen Seraph staged the attack to seize power.
Which is wild.
What's fascinating here is how perfectly Simon's reaction models cognitive dissonance.
Oh, absolutely.
When a deeply held belief is challenged, the brain doesn't just, review the data. It treats contradictory info as a literal physical threat.
Because his whole understanding of this fantasy realm was built on Lord April being the strong leader they needed.
Exactly. It wasn't just an opinion, it was his psychological safety net.
Which makes Alice's counter move so tragic, really. She tries to solve an emotional crisis with empirical data.
Right, the photograph.
Yeah, she has Hannah pull out the Opticon. It's this magical device that produces an objective photograph proving Eowyn's true identity.
Undeniable proof.
You would think. She shows it to him, and Simon just goes white. He clenches his fists, shakes his head, and says, "Pictures lie."
Wow. He just outright rejects it.
He argues that anyone could have used magic to fake the image.
And that's the backfire effect in action. Presenting undeniable proof to someone captured by a false reality just makes them dig in deeper.
The evidence becomes part of the conspiracy.
Exactly. In Simon's mind, the fact that Alice has this photo is just proof that she's in on the Queen's plot.
It's so much like a modern conspiracy theorist. You show them a fact check and they view the very existence of the fact check as proof of the cover-up.
Right, the effort to prove them wrong is seen as a threat.
But I have to push back here a little bit. Is Simon actually a traitor? I mean, he throws an eggshell smoke bomb and escapes to warn the enemies of the crown.
Right, he literally vanishes into the corridors.
Yeah, but is he malicious? Or is he just a tragic victim of a highly effective con man who knew exactly which buttons to push?
I'd argue framing him as a malicious traitor ignores the sophistication of the con. Aeon hijacks Simon's need for stability.
Right.
So when Alice shows the photo, she's demanding Simon accept he was fundamentally foolish and manipulated. That's a devastating blow.
He throws the smoke bomb to hide in his own denial.
Exactly. It's a cognitive fog as much as a physical one.
So Simon is now running loose, spreading these lies, and Alice and Hannah have to rush to the highest authority, the Council of All Houses.
And transitioning to that council room lets us see how systemic denial mirrors individual denial.
The room is incredible. It's got this translucent golden ceiling, 13 raised platforms for the different seasonal houses. It screams authority.
But underneath that gold ceiling, it's just catastrophic institutional paralysis.
Yeah, Queen Seraph is suspending the court thaumaturge, and her only job was to detect magic and deception.
And how did she fail?
She literally just forgot to give the third test of identity because she got distracted making polite conversation.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is a classic sociological phenomenon. It's called the normalization of deviance.
Oh, interesting. Like skipping steps.
Exactly. In high-trust environments, strict protocols erode over time. A worker skips a redundant step, nothing bad happens immediately, and it just becomes the new standard.
So the bureaucracy's sensory organs were just dulled by complacency?
Exactly. And the response to this failure is pure gridlock.
Complete gridlock. Lord October is shouting about gathering armies, demanding a unified general.
And Lord February just scoffs at him.
Right. He calls it a blatant partisan power grab. And then Hannah testifies. She says, look, I saw troll tracks heading west. And they just ignore her.
February sneers at her, right?
Yeah, calls her incompetent.
Massive institutions usually default to this kind of internal status jockeying when there's an existential threat. The troll army is too complex, so they focus on internal political rivals instead.
It's what they know.
Bureaucracies are optimized for debate, not agile crisis response.
But the queen realizes this. She sees the council is useless and quietly tasks a small group to go on a secret mission.
The textbook pivot. She bypasses the gridlock.
She picks Alice, Hannah, and Sir Tristan, this guilt-ridden elf knight who fell for the imposter's ruse to go to the greensward and wake Sir Theodore.
Bringing Tristan is a huge psychological risk. He's motivated by guilt, but unpredictable.
She's weaponizing his trauma.
Betting his need for redemption overrides his compromised judgment, yeah.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The meticulous preparation of this micro team.
They know they have no safety net.
None. So Alice has the Lady Sorceress Nimue stay behind to spot illusions. Hannah equips a specific swordbreaker dagger.
Very tactical.
And Alice literally packs her mortal purse and gives a cookie to a guard named Kuon before leaving.
Securing the home base before projecting force is a fundamental principle of special ops. They're using specialized tools and compartmentalization.
Which they desperately need, because the second they get to the greensward, they hit a wall.
Right. The environment shifts from that golden council room to this snow-covered, ruined mansion.
And there's a massive encampment of trolls and strange beasts camped directly over the siege.
The magical portal to Sir Theodore's Glen.
Yeah. So their grand strategy hits a huge tactical roadblock.
Three people can't launch a frontal assault on an army.
So they architect this massive distraction. It's like a classic heist movie distraction play, you know? Make a ton of noise at the front door so you can crack the vault out back.
A highly targeted diversion.
Exactly. Hannah uses glamoury to disguise herself and her horse Fiona as a red-eyed minion of Lord Eowyn, and she just rides straight into the camp.
Establishing false authority. By adopting the enemy's command aesthetic, she forces the trolls to pause.
Just long enough for phase two, Tristan and his horse, So Hate, act as high-value escaping prisoners.
They project the illusion of Lord April and the Lord Protector, Melchizedek.
This raises an important question, though. I have to ask, isn't this incredibly dangerous?
Oh, the risk parameters are extreme.
Right. You're impersonating the exact prisoners this monster army is looking for. What's a contingency if Tristan's horse trips in the snow?
If the disguise breaks, the mission fails, and the realm falls. But this raises an important question about asymmetric warfare. They lack numbers, so they brilliantly weaponize the enemy's own objectives against them.
Using their greed to capture the prisoners to clear the camp.
Exactly. And the decoy works because of this amazing intersection of material props and magic.
The plush doll. This is my favorite part.
Yes.
To sell the illusion of Lord Melchizedek, they use Alice's plush doll of Lord Mel. And she doesn't just hand it over. She earnestly asks the doll for help.
And what happens?
A magical breeze literally ripples through the trees. The guards shiver. The toy projects this tangible aura of real strength and presence.
We're seeing the ontological rules of Merari here. Perception is malleable. Alice's deep childhood earnestness generates a reality distortion field that's way stronger than standard sorcery.
It's incredible. So the army chases the decoys, and the infiltration team, Alice and the guards, start the stealth phase.
The tactical window is closing fast.
Alice is riding on the back of the Forouvgar Caradoc. She's squeezing her eyes shut, casting a glamour to blend in with the snow.
But the camp's passive security is still active.
Yeah, and they almost fail because they get tracked by scent, not sight.
Right, a massive white snowcat spots them.
Well, smells them. Visual magic is useless against a biological predator's nose.
An elemental problem requiring an elemental solution.
And Alice is a genius here. She reaches into her mortal purse, pulls out a pouch of catnip, and dumps it on the snow.
It's brilliant.
The beast is entirely biologically distracted.
Deploying catnip against a magical snow beast is the perfect example of cross-domain thinking. Sometimes the best countermeasure isn't a high-level spell. It's just understanding the underlying neurochemistry of the obstacle.
Which is such a great takeaway for you, the listener. You know, when you're overwhelmed by information or bureaucratic gridlock, sometimes you have to abandon complex systems.
Gather your micro team.
Exactly. Find whatever catnip you have in your own purse to distract the noise and carve a path to your own siege.
And their siege requires precise navigation.
They're dodging trolls, looking for an odd concavity where the ruined flower beds intersect near a snow-covered statue of the winged Lady Ariel.
Very specific markers.
Alice activates the siege, and they fall right into Sir Theodore's Glen.
And that transition is a profound semiotic boundary.
The contrast is mind-blowing. It's this warm, peaceful, fairy tale setting. Green grass, roses, sleeping knights.
The juxtaposition is key. You've got the gritty, high-stress reality of the snow camp outside.
Right, the trolls and disinformation.
Versus the pure, untouched mythology of the glen.
And right in the center, Sir Theodore is sleeping on a stone slab under an alabaster Pegasus. And his arms are folded over a leather-bound book.
A Bible.
With a blue silk bookmark. Alice recognizes it instantly.
Placing that specific artifact there is critical. It grounds this high fantasy setting in recognizable, real-world symbols of faith and protection.
It's a huge shift from the murky deception they just survived.
It communicates that Sir Theodore operates on moral absolutes.
So to summarize this whole journey, we went from Simon's dangerous disinformation in the infirmary to the council's complete paralysis.
To a brilliantly improvised tactical heist.
Fueled by a plush toy and catnip, it's just an amazing operational arc.
It's a blueprint for how small units can maneuver when massive institutions collapse.
Exactly. So I want to ask you, the listener, what stands out to you about how these characters handled the sudden collapse of their truth?
They didn't wait for the bureaucracy. They took micro-actions.
They adapted to the fractured light of that shattered mirror. And I want to leave you with one final provocative thought. The source text ends right as Alice reaches for the Bible to wake Sir Theodore. But think about this. If Sir Theodore and his knights have been asleep since an ancient, simpler era, what happens when they wake up?
Right, an era of moral absolutes.
Exactly. What happens when they wake up to a world where the lines between friend and foe are entirely blurred?
Where their own allies had to use dark illusions and fake prisoners just to reach them.
Will these ancient legends be able to adapt to a modern, morally complex reality defined by disinformation?
It really forces you to question if rigid moral frameworks can survive the psychological attrition of the present.
Definitely something to mull over as you navigate the fractured mirrors in your own life. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
We'll catch you next time.